So Jerry and his family have been a fixture here in our church family for decades. How far back does that go now?
1980.
I was a sophomore in high school.
Appreciate that. Yeah.
I can make it worse.
Yeah. Don't. But Jerry is one of these guys that just sort of quietly serves our church family behind the scenes. He's been a deacon here for years and years. I think most of that time, if not all of it, his area of responsibility has been the care of the building. And so he's one of those unsung heroes that just kind of goes behind the scene, taking care of things and getting them done, and has served this church family well for years and years. And so that's really his place, sort of working behind the scenes. To be up here on the stage in front of all you is, well, can we just say it's outside your comfort zone?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong, and I'm up here, so.
So let's just begin by saying to you a little bit about why Jerry's up here, because some of you know, I think, and some of you don't. In 2018, Jerry passed through what Jeff and I call his Job season. Jerry experienced an extraordinary health crisis, and literally it was a crisis that brought him about as close to the end of his life as one can possibly get and then live to tell about it. And that's what 2018 was like for him. And then, in the middle of all of that, just a number of other family crises that that came in his life and Kathleen's life as well. And yet, what I think in times, in the cases of other people, would have been things that drove them to despair. I think Jerry will tell you tonight that his season has actually strengthened his faith. And so I know a lot of you have talked to Jerry, like I have, and have had your faith strengthened by his story. And several of you have been pressing for some time for Jerry to say something to all of us about that. And so we've kicked that around for a couple of years probably now. And we finally settled that this would be a good setting for him to do that. And so we are really thankful. I know it's a courageous thing for you to be up here sharing with us tonight, and we all really appreciate that on your end. But be at ease, because look in the crowd. This is all your family here. And and we're sitting around the table at Thanksgiving just talking to each other tonight. So
totally
I thought it would be important to let Jerry tell us a little about 2018, because I know to a lot of us, we know the story very well, but a lot of you have come to Kleinwood since 2018 and may not know anything about this story at all. And really, the story is really, really important. So are you okay with visiting 2018 a little bit?
Yeah, we can go there for a little while.
Go there for a little while. Let's start out in February, because that's when you got sick.
It is. So if you look at things, that year started out very normal as far as our family goes. And I had a new granddaughter, had a brand new job, and everything was going really well. In fact, Kathleen and I had sat down literally a couple of weeks before I got sick, and we're talking about how God had blessed us, and we were just richly blessed. I'd gone to the doctor the end of January, and ironically, he pronounced me very fit and ready to go for another year. Even all the tests indicated that, too. It was nothing out of the ordinary. Even further than that, we played in a softball tournament with my boys the 1st of February, and you know, we played 7 games, and there was just no indication there was anything going on. Less than a month later, I'm in ICU, kind of wondering what hit me and where we're going with this. And it literally became like the movie Groundhog Day. I don't know how to describe it other than the fact that every day the exact same things happened, and the exact same words the doctor said is, "We don't know."
So it started like with bronchitis.
It did. Just started as a little cough, and you know, wouldn't go away, and was kind of pesky,
and it got worse.
It did get worse. I can only describe it like this. If you've ever, I've been told, maybe if you have asthma real bad, and you have an asthma attack where you cough and you literally, all the air goes out, but then it feels like you're sucking back in a little stir stick straw. Literally cannot get the air back in your lungs. And so Kathleen, to her credit, said, you are not sleeping right at night. Your chest cavity is doing very bizarre things. Yeah, I don't know, I was asleep. So she takes me to the ER, and that's where the story begins, literally begins. I argued with the ER doctor and said, you don't know what you're talking about. There's really nothing wrong. Just give me some stuff and let me go. I've got things to do, you know, this new job. I had a meeting the next day. And I'll never forget, you know, looking back on it, just how naive I was with that. I really argued with the doctor, let me go home. And he just said, no, you're our guest now. And so it ended up that after all these treatments and x-rays and biopsies and everything, they came to me at the end of that, end of March, first of April, and just said, we don't know. I have no idea what's wrong with you, other than the fact that now your lungs are so scarred, you're going to have a lung transplant. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that is probably the most foreign thing I've ever thought of until that moment they tell you that. And with full disclosure, I think I still have a little bit of hard time where I'm at with that, and that I'm literally breathing with somebody else's lungs. They moved me to the medical center in the first week of April, and started going through all the matching and typing and just all the other stuff you have to do, and still testing, trying to figure out what's going on to see if they could stop what had happened. But it was pretty obvious to the doctors that it wasn't going to be a reversible thing. And yeah. One of the ironic things they said was that this is not real uncommon to see people that have no underlying health issues or bad habits or any other things that might contribute to this, that all of a sudden they just immediately just get sick and it starts going downhill real quick. In fact, we met some of them while we were at Methodist Hospital.
And so just to underscore, Jerry, and all this, your lungs aren't working. I mean, you can't breathe, even with all the oxygen, all the help they're giving you while you're waiting for a transplant.
No. Breathing is not overrated, is my is my motto. I really don't even know how to describe what that's like. I'm sure there's some people here, like I said, that have different, you know, different things that go on, and they're real quick to say, but it wasn't as serious as yours. And I'm like, look, you know, not breathing is not breathing, right? Yeah. And so, I was on 100% oxygen the whole time. And the bad thing was, is that the disease was just still progressing at a very rapid rate. They could not mitigate it or even slow it down. And so that's not typical for IPF or idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. It usually drags out over a period of months and years before you have to get to that point. But again, they said that's not uncommon either, that you can get a case sometime that is just really accelerating quickly. I'm not real sure how to describe when you pray for your next breath. There's a desperateness in it, if that's a word, that I can't convey to people. When you're just mindful of every bit of air coming into you, you're almost like counting it when it comes in. And that became a hard prayer for me because, you know, as we'll talk about later, I certainly could have just quit too if I would have had some permission to quit, but I wasn't getting any permission to quit. So it was just a very difficult time as far as that goes physically. You know, I've even had some nurses that were saying, you know, you're the mental part of that was just almost as bad as the physical part of it. Your mind really starts doing some crazy things when you can't breathe.
And Jeff and I have labeled this your Job season, because right. It wasn't just your physical health. There were other things going on in your family. For example, in June, your daughter-in-law died suddenly. That's something that the people in this church family remember. Many of y'all knew Emily, and we hosted her funeral here at Kleinwood. And literally, this kind of, you know, the bizarre thing about this story, your transplant came virtually at the same time of her death and funeral.
It did. The night, or that Sunday of her memorial service here, Kathleen came back to the hospital, and they had a bed that she was laying next to me, and doctors had told her really not to leave. And it was about an hour later, you know, we went through the first live stream I ever saw from Kleinwood was that service. And some brethren were very good to bring laptop up there and let me see it. And so literally that night around 10:30, I got a call that I thought was going to be another robocall that had been on my phone. And this nice lady says, you know, Mr. Strode, we're flying in lungs for you, and we're coming to get you. So it was a very emotional roller coaster is an understatement to go through that. With my illness the way it was, whenever Kathleen told me about Emily, which there was some debate about doing that too, that there was going to be a reaction of, that's it, that's enough stuff for 2018. She said I had a very muted reaction to it, which I thought was very strange. But then again, you know, when your brain's not getting the oxygen it needs, you do kind of strange things. But that one, Emily's death still has a profound impact on me and my family.
So you were able to get the transplant literally as time was running out for you, and
right,
and the lungs were provided, and lengthy recovery after that. Say a word or two about your current status. Where are you right now?
So the average lifespan of a double lung transplant patient is 5 years, and I'm at 4.5. Whatever God decides to let me go, then I'll just roll with that for right now. I try to get up every morning and watch the sun come up. It just means a little bit more to me now. So we're just going to use each day as we can, you know, for God's glory about that.
So it's been an ordeal, 2018, and the journey since that point in time. And so I wanted everybody to know the story, so that as we move on and talk a little bit about what you've learned, you'll understand both in terms of what he has been through and what Jerry is facing, the perspective he brings to the conversation tonight. So I'm really curious about your view of God through all of this, because I think, Jeff, it's common for people when they have their Job season to be angry with God,
right,
and to give up on God. And why did God let this happen to me? And so I'm just curious, did you have those feelings, and how you processed your view of God? I think you made the comment to me, as someone who's been doing this church thing my whole life for so long, and yet this happens to me. How did you process that?
Yeah, you know, this year is, I've been a Christian for 50 years, and one of the things that I will certainly tell people is legacy really means nothing. You know, my parents were Christians, my grandparents, my great-grandparents. And so, you know, as far as being in the church, there's really no excuse for really not knowing anything about being a Christian. I mean, that's just the reality of what I grew up in. This is the second half of that story of 2018 that it unraveled a lot of things that were very troublesome to me. I was a deacon, as you mentioned. You know, I tried to help serve people. I tried to do a lot of different things. But you know, my view of God is that we, you know, we came and we worshiped Him, and you know, we tried to do service. But you know, going through what I went through exposed something that was missing, really, really bad. I hate to use the word checking boxes. I mean, you said that this morning, and I hate to use it twice, but
it's all right.
It's something I think that people do without recognizing it. And the way God helped us in our situation was, it put me in a place where I really recognized who I was and how small I was. And I don't know if that makes sense, but when you see the awesomeness of what God is doing for you and what He did, and just open your eyes, you can see it every day. When the sister here said that she was almost scared to go before God because He's so big, I understood exactly what she meant. It's something that when you're totally incapacitated to do things, that you look at God and that's all you have. And really that's all we have now. We put fillers in there, you know, but really it's all you have. I remember laying there week three and literally saying to myself, uh-oh, you know, this doesn't feel right. I could feel my body betraying me and going down. So praying to God it was my daily ritual. And I will tell you that even, and I may jump ahead a little bit here, but that last week or that first week in June, my prayer was not, you know, about anything but God, either get me this transplant or let me die. I said, I can't do this anymore. I just literally, physically cannot do it anymore. And I don't know, I had never had a prayer like that before where the intensity was so much between me and God, because the noise of my life, my job, and that real important job that somebody else finished that year, my children, my family, anything I had was not even a fleeting thought in my brain.
It's interesting. You talked about getting to that place where there was nothing but God. Explore that a little bit.
And can I add to that?
Yeah.
The other thing that I think you said along that line is how big God became to you.
Right.
Because I think that's related to that you know, that's all you have. Now, ironically, the less of the clutter or noise, as you just called it, you have,
right,
the bigger God gets.
Yeah, and I'm not being disrespectful to my family calling them noise.
That used to fit back then.
But sometimes it does.
But when you're lying in bed and the end is there, that's all. It's just you and God. That's what you're talking about.
It is. And it's probably real difficult to comprehend that you would not be worried about your leaving of this life. You know, I had a sister say, well, and she doesn't attend here, thankfully, but she said, I would just think that in those last days that you would be, you know, your regrets that you had, wishing you could do your children different, I mean, whatever. And, you know, I just looked at her and I said, no, that's not even close to what you think about. You know, my family could come visit me, and literally 10 seconds after they walk out the door, your mind just goes back to where you're fixing to go. I mean, you're thinking about, you're going to go see God. And it really puts in perspective, I guess, how I felt before this happened, that the stuff around me was somehow who I was, and you know, all the stuff we hoard and try to make a living with. And I don't want to put a bunch of caveats, like, well, I know we got to work, you know, but I just think of the time I wasted by not being in His Word or praying to Him. And again, we say, well, we were doing things not in and of themselves wrong, but I think they are. I think if they push God out of your life, then I think they become wrong. And it was just a very refreshing thing to me. It was very peaceful to be able to constantly stay talking to God during that time. And, you know, one of the bad things about getting better is the noise starts creeping back in. And you start doing things and staying a little bit busy. And, you know, I go back to 2018 very regularly. Like I told y'all Friday that I go back and visit, because I don't want to forget. I don't want to forget what it was like to just be you and God.
It almost sounds like what you're saying is that from at least one angle, what happened to you was good for you spiritually.
I will make a statement that I have talked to four people, and they, probably three of them here tonight will remember this, but they said, listen, you know, would you do this again, going through this transplant with all the stuff you know is going to happen? You know, it's messed up your heart, you have a heart attack, now you have heart failure, you have kidney failure, you've got cancer. You know, would you do this again? And my answer is, like, absolutely I would, but you know, not to live 4 years and 5 months more. I think it saved my soul. I think that ordeal, and I believe Kathleen will tell you the same thing, that it caused us, it made us look at yourself for who you really are and not what you feel like you are. And that was a very terrifying thing. It really was.
It's interesting to me. I remember when we talked to Matt a few months back, I asked him the same question.
Yeah.
Are you angry with God? And did you ever tempted to turn on God because of what has happened? And you had this almost astonished reaction to it. You said, turn on God. It's the only place I have left to go. Yeah. And that's interesting. Listen, family, to what both of these brothers are saying to us from their unique perspectives, that there does come a point in time where the clutter is cleared and we realize what was true all along.
Right. Naked I came into this world and naked I leave it.
He's all
right.
I am.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Now, the question, and we kind of kicked this around in planning for this, and it's your question. You started this. So that was, is it possible to discover that without having to have a 2018?
You know, those don't hurt to have one of those. Not literally, it does hurt, but you know, that's a question. I think the answer has to be yes, that you can. I don't think that God would make it impossible for you unless you went through some death-defying thing, but with the understanding that you have to peel those onions like that, or pull those layers off those onions and get down to what you really know that you are. Like I said earlier, that not what you feel. We do things, I did things that made me feel better and compensated for really a lack of a relationship with God. You know, reading every day or praying every day. I almost feel like I substituted doing that stuff to make myself not feel guilty. And I think Satan's very subtle with that. I think he can do that. And I think he's real happy as long as he just takes your eye off of God for a little bit. He doesn't care about all the other stuff that you do. And another aspect of that is when all of that stuff is taken away from you, and you know your hospital bed is your entire life, and you can't go serve, or you can't go be a deacon, or you can't even attend services, you're left holding something. And if the relationship with God's not there, then you are doing things to be a Christian instead of being a Christian and having and just doing things.
It's interesting you say that, because I think some people would define their Christianity as what they do.
The doing.
I go to church on Sunday, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting, you talk about the things that you do, and I'm assuming part of that, like, is your work as a deacon.
Sure.
I'm doing these things.
Right.
And yet now you talk about, but there is this different thing. There is this relationship you have with Him. And I'm curious as to what that is to you.
So that's going down to the very essence of who you are. And taking it all away, because I truly believe that all of us sitting in here tonight and even people watching, you know if you are right with God. I mean, I've heard people say, I hope I am. Well, that's a yes or no question, not a hope question, right? So you know that there may be something in your life, or you know that your relationship with your spouse isn't right, or your kids, or to your parents, or something, and you can cover it up with all this other stuff that you do, but you have to be honest with yourself and go back there, and you have to talk to God about it, because God will show you. He will. He will show you where you're at, and but again, you really just have to be really truthful with yourself and not what you feel.
And Jerry, is it fair to say in what you're saying, because I think this is actually a really profound point that those of us who are, you know, healthy and active need to hear, which is, you know, what I'm hearing you say is we can actually use our good works, ironically the theme we've been talking about all year, they can be a form of actually hiding from God and hiding the truth about ourselves and our actual relationship with God. Is it fair to say that part of, you know, even what you've been through, what you learned, because you've always been, again, a very devoted deacon, servant, when we can do for God and do for others, we don't have that sense of dependence upon God, ironically, because we're now working with God, we're part of the team. And at the end of the day, what faith really comes down to is at some point you just have to be dependent upon God totally and completely. And so the irony is even our good works sometimes can cause us to lose that sense of utter dependence upon Him.
Yeah, and that's kind of the sad thing that I believe that I could say I had even like in January is I don't know, well, I do know, looking back on it, that there wasn't an utter dependence. There was the things that I did, and I believe that I tried to have a good heart. I was very good at the thou shalt nots,
yeah.
You know, which we most of us are. And but there's something about when you talk to God for several days, weeks, and months that your utter dependency on Him teaches you things about yourself that you really didn't know. And part of it is how we fool ourselves. And I hate to say it, that happened to me. I don't think I was really doing anything wrong as much as it was I wasn't doing the things I should be doing. And like I said about reading and all that, I was trying to be a good person. Ironically, I even made this comment to Kathleen several weeks in. I looked at her, and I still to this day don't know why I said it, but I said, I thought I was a good person. And she looked at me and she says, well, you know, you are a good person. And I just started thinking, why did I say that to her? And it wasn't like I thought God was punishing me, but lessons were being learned very quickly. Let's just put it that way, of your place in life. When you can't do anything without a nurse or nurses doing it for you, there's a harsh reality that you're not in charge anymore. And I told that to a nurse one time when she came in. I said, yeah, I feel like I'm not in charge anymore. And And she just looked at me with these eyes. She says, "You were never in charge in the first place." And she walked out. We ended up having some very good spiritual conversations.
Yeah, so it sounds like she knows what she's talking about.
She did. And our lives make it sometimes very difficult for us to totally depend on God. We're pretty self-sufficient creatures, I believe. And lessons will come to you about that. And they'll teach you a different way to look at it, I guess.
You've talked a lot about prayer, and I'd like you just to unpack that a little bit for us, because I'm getting the sense that before, during, and after prayer changed a whole lot for you.
Yeah, it did.
Beginning in 2018.
It did. I can tell you that before, my prayer life was, I'm going to use the words describing myself, it was unremarkable. They were usually theme-driven, you know. It was, okay, we're going to pray before, you know, we eat, or we're going to pray in the morning when we get up, or, you know, a special occasion, or whatever, you know, or participate in services here. And I think the words were being said that were, you know, that needed to be said. But I will tell you that beginning of that journey, my prayer was more of an irritation than anything to God. I was irritated that I had this brand new job and I had things to do, and I was being held hostage. Week two, I literally said, "No, really, God, I'm serious. You know, I'm serious. This is, I need to get out of here." And I started thinking, man, admitting you weren't serious the first time, you know, you said it, but, you know, week three was the uh-oh moment where things started changing, and the conversation with God started changing too. It's different when you're talking about praying for different things, and then you're praying for your survival. That is a desperate prayer that it comes quite easily when you're in that position. And really, as the after effect of the prayers, I found a really hard time saying "please give me" or whatever anymore. I there's more thanksgiving, I hope, in my prayers, and more praise to Him, and more His will be done and His glory be shown in things, because I don't think there's anything wrong with please praying for your health or your family or things like that. But again, when it comes down to it, it's going to be you and Him. And nobody's going to hold your hand when you go through it. So you need to develop that. I would hope at a young age that you have that prayer life where you have a real deep conversation with God and just let it go, because there is no formality when you're praying for breath. I will tell you, there's not a good starting, middle, and end to that. It is just one plea. And it's the most intense plea I think I've ever had. And that's what I want to keep in my heart, is how that taught me a lesson about that relationship with God. And where it's supposed to be versus where I thought it should be.
And Jerry, when it comes to your prayer life, when the three of us were talking about, just talking all this out the other day, you said something. I hope if I'm misremembering, you can tell me. No, Jeff, that's your crazy brain. But you said something that at least stuck in my head, if I remember correctly. You said that you never really got to the point where you were bargaining with God.
Right.
In other words, a lot of people, I think, maybe even some of us in here, and I certainly, David, you may too, in the work that we do. I mean, I've known people who've admitted to me after they went through a crisis that they bargained with God. You know, God gets me through this, then I will, fill in the blank. I'll pay God back. But it struck me, it came out organically as we were talking recently.
Right.
Because I think for most of us, that's exactly where we'd wind up, or at least be tempted to wind up. But say more about how and why that did not factor, because you were on death's door,
right?
And then again, Emily, just these waves of tragedy,
right?
But you didn't bargain with God.
No, I didn't, because when you bargain, that means that you can do something.
Yeah.
And I was very, I'll be very adamant today to tell you, I couldn't do anything for God. And when you get to that point to where you understand that you have no leverage, bargains sound a little silly. They really do. I'm not going to tell you I didn't pray so that I could, you know, bring him glory or something like that. But there was no, please get me out of here and I'll, praise 10 times a day instead of five. I mean, it literally sounds like you have some sort of sway in this, and you just don't. You are helpless.
I think it's interesting that by the end of 2018, arguably, in almost every way, you had less than you started with.
Right.
Yet you said you also asked for less by the time all that was over.
Yeah, you just got to be very careful what you pray for. I know we joke about praying for patience, and then, you know, somebody comes into your life that you have to really practice it. But, you're very limited in really what you can do. My prayer, I hope now, is more of a positive prayer, because I really don't pray praying for jobs or stuff that aren't going to ever happen again, or, material things just don't really make Kathleen and I's list anymore. Yes, you've got to have stuff to live and all that, but I mean, they're just put in such a perspective of how they don't matter, because I remember laying in that hospital and just not having any fleeting thought of that. And I think that Kathleen will tell you that there was probably a time when it was really getting bad that she probably didn't have a lot of that stuff on her mind either. I can tell you I wasn't worried about my 401k when you're praying about, can I please take another breath? And so it literally leaves your mind. And I've had people tell me that they hope that when their time comes that they can, say another prayer before they go. And I don't know about that. I think maybe you need to say them now and not wait till that time. But some of us aren't going to have, months to think about it. I just think our prayers need to be centered on God all the time, and we need to talk to him multiple times a day.
It sounds like your priorities have shifted.
A little.
I guess when you get to that place where your prayer is, give me another breath, that doesn't just change you in the moment, that it changes you forever.
It does, David. And you know, again, the whole episode has really put in place where material things in this world, their value really are. When I talk about it, I express remorse about the time I wasted. I can't really spend that any different way. I wish I'd spent more Bible class time with my children. I wished I had, prayed more and studied more. I can't undo that or unring that bell, but I can going forward. And I just wish you could take everybody, young people that have young kids here, and pour this in their brain about the time. And I mean, you referenced that this morning about the investment that it takes to be a Christian. And we literally just run God out of our lives because we put ourselves in the middle, and God goes around it, and we fit him in whatever slot we can instead of him being in the middle. And hey, if we can play baseball, fine. If not, if that interferes with us being a Christian, we won't. Again, I'm not anti-sports. It's just that I got used up this morning too much. So.
And Jerry, one of the other things that along with this, changed view of life, and you didn't put it quite this explicitly when we were talking the other day, but I think you were right up there, and I hope I'm not pushing you further than you want to go, but one of the things that I heard in some stuff when we were all talking, mm-hmm. you obviously your change about, the what's important in life and how you'd use time and so forth, but your view of death itself, because you've been to the edge and back, at least what I thought I heard and something that when we were talking the other day. Can you say a little bit about that? Because you've been to the edge of the abyss and back.
The next time this happens, I don't think there'll be any fear at all. I know that sounds very, I don't know, maybe morbid or even bizarre to some people, but dying is very, very easy. I always thought it was one of those things where you would hang on by your fingernails, kicking and screaming, going out. And man, when you accept the reality of where you're at and that your life is leaving you, it goes without saying that your perspective changed, but your mental outlook on that is just, I can't describe it, the most peaceful thing that you will ever have. And because you finally laid down all your worries, right? All your things, even the sting of leaving Emily, when that day was getting closer and closer, it didn't hurt quite as bad, because I'm thinking, well, may I get to go see her, right? And so when this comes on again, and it will, I don't have a crystal ball, but I will tell you, I will probably go out the same way I almost did. Going to see God is something that makes this place so insignificant even more, all the English people out there are probably cringing, but it really puts in perspective this life and just how futile all the pain and the hurt that you go through in this life. And when you can finally lay all that down, and the skids were greased, I mean, we were going right down there to it. It's a great feeling. I know that probably sounds very bizarre to people, but it is, because you finally have just given things to God and let it go.
Yeah. You talk like you're a free man.
You are very free, very free.
I don't want time to get away from us without saying some things about the impact of your church family on your Job season. So I know that you feel like you were generously supported by your brothers and sisters.
All right.
You'll talk some about that?
Generous is a very understatement. This family here, I can tell you, there would have been a different outcome if this church family hadn't done what it did. I was literally overwhelmed by things. I have a trash bag at home that I keep in a closet that is literally just full of hundreds of cards. I kept the drawings from the children that they made in their class. There's a story to that a nurse told me. She said, when I was admitted for something, it actually was coronavirus, but it wasn't COVID-19, back in 2019. I asked her about some different things, and she said, Mr. Strode, she said, because I told her they were not going to give me the transplant because I was too sick. And she says, with that story, she said, when those doctors would come in and they saw all those cards stuck on the wall, I mean, just like almost like wallpaper, and all the kids' drawings and everything, and one of those doctors came in and he's just looking at all that stuff, and he's on the committee to decide whether you do it or not. And he saw a picture of Emily, of all things, and he said, is that her? I didn't even know he knew. And Kathleen's like, yeah, that's our daughter-in-law. And he started tearing up before he went back into doctor mode and went on. Well, she said, you'll never know how much that impresses doctors. He says, because those doctors come to the nurses and say, who came to see him today? How many people came to see him? And it made a profound impact on that medical staff. And I am convinced that that's why they changed their mind and said, yes, we're going to do it. Aside from the fact that there was probably two times that this congregation saved my life was, when Lana organized that that prayer chain through the whole night. I was just overwhelmed when I heard about that, and Craig told me what was going on. And
describe that, because there will be people here who won't even know what that is.
Well, I found out about it after, really the depth of it after the fact, but Craig Hodges had told me, he came to see me, and him and Denise were actually staying there to fly out the next morning after my transplant. And he said, yeah, he said, you know, Lana has this prayer chain where people are signing up to pray for an hour at a time. And, you know, finding out how that just literally looks like it kind of exploded. All these people were signing up to pray for me at night. And
during the surgery, right?
During the surgery.
Because the surgery started, what, about midnight?
It was around 10 o'clock, I think. The doctor, and along those lines, the doctor had come in and said, you know, he says, I got to tell you some things that are going to happen, and I don't want you to be upset if you wake up in recovery and we're taking you back into surgery, because he says, you know, you're going to bleed really bad. He goes, the way that your scar tissue is really bad. And he goes, and you're going to have a heart attack on the table. And he goes, but we're prepared for that. And he said, and your left lung will not inflate because of nerve damage from the disease. And he said, and I'll see you in about 8 to 12 hours. And so 4 hours later, the doctor comes out and talks to my daughter and says, yeah, he didn't bleed, and you know, he didn't have a heart attack. And he said, we went to inflate that lung and it just totally inflated. So if you ever wonder if prayer works, you know, I'll wave at you sometime. I'm truly convinced that the reason nothing went wrong and everything went as well as it did was the prayers of this church and others, you know, praying all over. Like I said, getting the cards, it always impressed me when there was a lot of handwriting in there, because somebody has put some thought to it. And during a time like that, some of the best cards I've ever read came up out of that, because you could just tell that the people sending it was just so on their heart, and they were just pouring it out back to you. And I just think we need to take note that, you know, mine was a big deal, but there's a lot of people that go through big deals, and they don't, maybe it's not as known, or, you know, it doesn't get as much publicity about it, but, you know, we need to look for people to go help like that. You cannot go through things by yourself, especially when you've got a family like this that will literally drop what they're doing to come help you.
I there are two things, I think, and you've said both of them, but they deserve to be underlined and emphasized. The first one was that there are other hurting people.
Right.
Your illness, I think, did get a lot of notice. Lots. Yeah. In fact, you said you've heard from brethren literally all across the country.
I did.
And that's true. But you make such a great point to say that there are others who are hurting and suffering that sometimes are overlooked or missed because maybe they haven't even shared or nobody knows.
Right.
And there's value in looking for those people. And then the other thing that I heard you saying is there's value in things that we would judge to be the small thing.
Right.
So a card that I sent out and wrote with my own hand, some kind of expression for someone who's going through a tough season, what an impact that could make on somebody.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I had a sister here say, you know, all I did was write a card. And I'm like, you have no idea what that card did. And I really hope that people don't dismiss whatever gesture they put towards somebody as being too small. But also really encourage people that if you are going through something, you can lighten that burden up by letting other people help you. In the beginning, when I first got sick, I said that. I said, I didn't want any visitors, you know. I didn't want people to see me in that condition, you know. I mean, I can take care of myself. And you just have to come to a conclusion that you need to let other people help. It helps other people when you let them help you. And I just think it's a win for both sides on that.
So Have you carried away from all of this a different feeling about church family?
There's a closeness here, I feel, to people, or really to everybody that was here during that time, that it's difficult to describe. I felt close to people here before, but when they see you at your worst and you're still their friend, even though you got nothing for them, that resonates with me. I could stand up here and list several men that came down there regularly. I mean, just like clockwork. And that just lifted my day every time I saw somebody, because it's not really a place that you want to spend a lot of time in ICU or something like that. In fact, some people probably shouldn't, you know, be in those places. But, you know, there is a closeness now that I feel that I don't think I had before this happened.
So, real quick, because the time's just about up, but I know a concern that you have is as you move away from 2018, clearly you've gained some valuable insights from that. And I know your concern is about losing that perspective that you've developed. What have you done to insulate yourself against that?
You know, prayer has a good way of helping you. You know, if you're worried about staying connected with God, I think if you just connect with God, that kind of takes care of itself now. And reading, you know, the way that we have to do it in our family, Kathleen has to almost read it out loud to me because I can't, some of the medicines make it very difficult for me to focus. And, you know, we try, we're not perfect. I will tell you that this whole thing has not made us any better than anybody else. It just made us better than the people we were. And I'll always be thankful to God that I was able to go through that. Because when you look at the importance of it, it's not about this earthly body. If it chugs on for two more years or whatever, it's about where your soul's going to go with that. And I just, it's a prayer that I can readily say that I do appreciate God letting me do that. I would never think I would have that ease of saying that to him before this happened.
It makes me think of the song that I can't sing anymore, thanks to you. Jesus, draw me ever nearer. You ever notice the third verse of that song says, may the treasure of the trial form within me as I go. Right. That's the part I can't get through.
That song, I think my nurses hated it. I would put that on a loop, and I would listen to that song. It started at Willowbrook, and I would listen to it for months at a time. And in fact, there's a video that Drew Lopez came to see me. I did not know he did, and it's sitting on my chest, just going over and over. And so it meant a whole lot to me at the time I was going through it. It's very emotional now when it's led here. I just have to kind of look at the words.
Hey, thank you for sharing the treasures of your trial with all of us tonight. I know if you would be interested in hearing more from Jerry about his journey and how he might help you, I know he'd be willing to do that. We're out of time. Let's pray together, and we'll be dismissed. Thanks for coming tonight. It's been a blessing, Father, to be in your presence and with your people. We are grateful tonight for what you have done for Jerry, not just for the healing that you gave his body, but the revival that you gave his soul. And may his message inspire and revive us as well. In Jesus' name, amen.